Hello everyone and welcome to the Cure Panel Talk Show on Myeloma. I'm Priya Menon, Scientific Media Editor at Cure Talk, and along with the Cure Talk team of Shadip Khan and Chintan Patel, I welcome all of you this evening to a discussion on multiple myeloma. As always, we will be moderating the call and bringing people live on the show. Cure Panel Talk Show is organized by Cure Talk, the blog of Trialix.com, an online platform to connect patients to clinical trials of new treatments. For information on clinical trials for all conditions, please visit Trialix.com/ask. And for information about clinical trials on myeloma, please visit MMRF site myelomatrials.org. This is the 20th episode of the Cure Panel Talk Show, and today's show has been selected to be featured on Block Talk Radio. Before we begin with the introductions, I would like to remind all our supporters and audience that we are having a great lineup of shows for you this August, which is our anniversary month too. We will be launching two new talk series, one a series for young adult cancer survivors, and we are featuring CEO of Stupid Cancer, Matthew Zachary, and New York Times Life Interrupted columnist and young adult cancer survivor, Suleka Juwad, on our inaugural episode on August 8th at 6 p.m. ET. We are also launching a series on breast cancer, and our featured expert is Dr. Julie Grallo of Seattle Cancer Care Alliance. She will be discussing latest treatments in breast cancer, advanced versus early stage, On August 21st, we will see us host our monthly myeloma discussion with Dr. Ravi Vij from Washington University and Annie Quinn Young of MMRF. We will be discussing allotransplants, pros and cons. Coming back to today's panel, today we have with us eminent myeloma expert Dr. Shaji K. Kumar of Mayo Clinic. And on the panel, we have noted myeloma author and survivor Pat Killingsworth, myeloma survivor and advocate Jack Aiello, and myeloma survivor and humorist Nick Van Dyke. Gary Peterson, editor of MyelomaSurvival.com, is co-hosting the show with me. I extend a hearty welcome to one and all. I would like to remind all listeners that we will be taking live questions at the end of the discussion. Listeners who have a question for our panel can let us know by pressing 1 on their keypads, and we will bring them live on air to ask their questions. Gary would now introduce us to the expert and the topic of today's discussion. Gary, you're on air.
Thank you very much, Priya. That was a very nice introduction. One thing that you hadn't mentioned is that, and maybe you did and I just missed it, is that Pat Killingsworth will have his, I think it's his third cure panel discussion, you know, and it's really a support group, an international support group, and he's going to be talking about the rights of the myeloma patient and being an empowered myeloma patient. That'll happen on July 31st at 6 p.m., so I figured I'd add that in. Now, every year there's three major meetings on oncology and on hematology and focus on multiple myeloma, the first of which is ASH, the American Society of Hematology, the second, the European Hematology Association annual meeting, and then the ASCO, which is the American Society of Clinical Oncology. And this was just provided in June of 2013, or just it was conducted in June of 2013 in Chicago. And usually these things have a tremendous amount of information that comes out, and it takes a goodly amount of time to be digested by most people. A lot of times they do it right away, but there is so much information that it takes a while for it to be digested, understood, and then ready for ready for use in the clinic. Now, Dr. Shaji Kumar will be talking about the highlights from the 2013 ASCO meeting. Now, it's a pleasure to have Dr. Shaji Kumar back here for the second time. He's an associate professor of medicine at Mayo Clinic and the College of Medicine. He's a consultant for Mayo as well in clinical oncology. He is a member of a bunch of different societies. I won't mention them all, but he'd have to have two or three different cards to fill it up. You know, his laboratory focuses on development of novel drugs for the treatment of myeloma. He has been published in a numerous peer-reviewed journals, including the British Journal of Hematology, Blood, American Journal of Hematology, Bone Marrow Transplant, on the myeloma topic. And he's also what I consider part of a dream team that was put together at the Mayo Clinic. And that team includes Drs. Kumar, Dr. Raj Kumar, Dr. Kyle Lacey, Dr. Chanan Khan, and Dr. Fonseca. So I consider them to be one of the best group, maybe the best in the world, of minds that are working on multiple myeloma and providing us with some great care and answers. So with that, I'd like to turn it back over to Priya, where she will lead the discussion and ask Dr. Kumar some questions.
Thank you, Gary. Welcome to the show, Dr. Kumar.
Thanks, Priya. Thanks, Gary.
Thank you. Dr. Kumar, starting with the discussion, what were the three key findings discussed at the ASCO this year?
So it's always hard to pinpoint what is the most important piece of information. There's so much of information that comes out at these meetings. Nearly all of it are all important in their own different ways. But I think if you just look at the different themes that kind of came out from ASCO and also from the ASH from December of last year, the concept of looking for minimal residual disease how much of myeloma is left behind after treatment is increasingly becoming the focus of a lot of different studies. Now, this is not a new concept. It has been around for a lot of the leukemias, especially the chronic myelogenous leukemia, where Gleevec has really made a difference in the treatment. So I guess in myeloma, we are starting to look at it now more often because we have all these new treatments that have really made a difference to the disease and is able to bring down the tumor burden to a very small fraction of what it starts off at. So minimal residual disease basically refers to the microscopic or extremely small amount of tumor or myeloma that's left behind at the conclusion of a successful treatment. Now, the ways we have been looking at it has been rather crude so far. We just look at the bone marrow aspirate under the microscope and see if there are any plasma cells or myeloma cells. But that is very low sensitivity, or the ability to pick up residual plasma cells is very low. However, more recently, several techniques have been put forth, the two most commonly used being something called flow cytometry, where you run the bone marrow aspirate through a flow cytometer and you can study 500,000 cells and find out if there is residual or myeloma cells left behind. Another way of looking at it is something called a PCR, which again, you basically take the bone marrow aspirate and you process it and basically look and see if we can identify residual myeloma cells. So there was a very interesting study that was presented at ASCO where the Spanish group had looked at a method called deep sequencing, where they were able to study 68 patients from a clinical trial and compare that with what is considered today's standard, which is the flow cytometry. And they were able to show that they could detect minimal amounts of disease in patients who were considered to be in complete response. Over half of those patients considered to be in complete response had some minimal amounts of tumor cells left behind. And these patients didn't do as well as the ones who did not have anything left behind. So I think it just goes on to show that as we increase our ability to detect small amounts of residual tumor after therapy, we can identify who are the patients who are going to do better. And maybe this can also be incorporated into future clinical trials where we might try and see if giving more treatment to patients who have tumor left behind would actually have any impact in the long term. And I think these are all, the small steps that we are taking towards hopefully what would hopefully be a cure for this disease. So I think, you know, that study, along with a couple other ones, had highlighted the importance of minimal residual disease. And I think we're all going to be seeing and hearing a lot more about different ways of assessing minimal residual disease. Another very important study, I think, was the presentation by Dr. Dedopkar, who presented the results of a long-running trial looking at the outcome of patients with monoclonal gammopathy of undetermined significance and smoldering multiple myeloma. Now, we all know these all patients with myeloma originally go through this monoclonal gammopathy of undetermined significance and then the smoldering multiple myeloma. But the majority of the patients with these conditions don't necessarily go on to develop myeloma and need therapy. So what this study, which was basically an observational study involving several hundreds of patients who have been watched over the past almost 10 years, Dr. Dedopkar was able to show that some of the previously recognized markers like the amount of monoclonal protein or myeloma protein, as well as the amount of plasma cells or myeloma cells in the bone marrow, do predict the risk of progression to myeloma that need therapy. But what was also important was that he could actually look at some gene expression signatures, and these are tests that are gradually coming into the clinic, that he was able to identify patients at a very high risk of progressing to multiple myeloma, which then opens up the option for designing clinical trials to intervene early and with the hope that we might actually be able to cure this disease by catching them at an earlier phase. Again, these are hypotheses which needs to be confirmed through clinical trials, but this study, I think, was very critical, as you know, it's important results, and that's something that has taken a long time to do. Then there were presentations on several new drugs. I think one of the most exciting one was the results from a monoclonal antibody called daratumumab, which is targeted against a protein on the surface of myeloma cells called CD38. Now, the monoclonal antibodies have been used for treatment of a lot of different cancers, particularly lymphoma, where rituximab has been around for a long time. So there has always been this hope that we can actually develop monoclonal antibodies for treating myeloma as well. And I think the results that were presented by Dr. Lockhurst really highlighted the fact that this antibody was well-tolerated. It's given intravenously, initially once weekly, then it's given every 2 weeks, and then given every 4 weeks. And they were able to see over a third of the patients in whom the myeloma protein had gone down with treatment with its monoclonal antibody. So based on these exciting trials, this medication is now currently in larger trials, and hopefully we'll get to the clinic in the near future. So I would say those three would be some of the top ones. You know, again, there are several others which are also important in terms of the type of information it provides.
In addition to daratumumab, what other new agents were are being tested for myeloma and discussed at the ASCO?
Right. So if you look at the clinical trials that are ongoing in multiple myeloma, the new drugs that we are seeing can, you know, you can group them into the ones which are new versions of existing classes of drugs, which would be like drugs which are similar to the bortezomib or carfilzomib, drugs that are similar to the Revlimid or lenalidomide. Then there are other drugs which are totally new classes of drugs which works in through mechanisms which are very different than what the currently available drugs do. And then there is a lot of clinical trials looking at combinations of the new drugs as well as old drugs. And then finally, these monoclonal antibodies, which are, again, a new class of drugs. So the daratumumab results were quite interesting. There was the results of the trial from a trial using the medication called MLN9708, which is very similar to Velcade, but the advantage is it can be given by mouth. It's a pill that you take once a week, and also causes less neuropathy than Velcade does. So the initial trial, the phase one trial of this drug, which we were part of, we were able to show that this medication did help patients who have previously been exposed to various other treatments, and we saw some good responses with this drug. And this drug is now going forward into phase 3 clinical trials in combination with Revlimid and dexamethasone, both in patients with relapsed myeloma as well as newly diagnosed myeloma. Then the other new drugs, there are some results that Dr. Lonil presented with the long-term outcome of another monoclonal antibody, which is the elotuzumab, which, again, in combination with Revlimid and dexamethasone in patients with relapsed myeloma, we had previously seen very promising results. And, again, this drug has already completed a phase 3 clinical trials, and we are all anxiously awaiting the results of that study. There were results presented from two different drugs, both belonging to the class of histone deacetylase inhibitors, which is, an exciting class of medication, but again, we need to wait and see what the results from the larger studies show. Then there were several trials that the results of which were presented, which were looking at combinations. So there were combinations of carfilzomib with melphalan and prednisone in patients, in older patients, and the results seem to be quite similar to what you would have expected with, say, bortezomib or Velcade when it's combined with melphalan and prednisone. The carfilzomib was also combined with Revlimid and dexamethasone, and this, again, is a long-term results of the previous studies, again, showing that this combination is very active, both in patients with newly diagnosed myeloma and in relapsed multiple myeloma. And the responses that we saw with this combination was fairly durable and long-lasting. Now, similarly, pomalidomide, again, or Pomalyst, it's already approved, but there were some long-term results from the phase 3 trials as well as looking at subgroups of patients. So the phase 3 trial, as you may have already heard, compared the Pomalyst and low doses of dexamethasone against high doses of dexamethasone and showed that the combination did much better than just the dexamethasone alone, allowing patients to live longer. So now that it's approved, there have been clinical trials looking at combinations, and one of the most exciting combinations is the combination of Pomalyst along with Velcade and dexamethasone. And this, again, some early results were presented by Dr. Richardson. And this combination, the combination of pomalidomide, dexamethasone, and doxorubicin or Doxil also appeared to be quite promising, even though it was associated with quite a few side effects as well. So I think overall, you see these new drugs coming along, and I suspect many of them are going to be available in the clinic in the next 3 or 4 years. And then there's also a lot of exciting data from clinical trials trying to combine these new drugs with the old drugs. So I think eventually we'll be looking at a scenario where we are going to have these new drugs, old drugs, used in a very effective combinations, that which hopefully will give us better control of this disease.
Dr. Kumar, which agent do you think has immediate implications for the treatment of myeloma?
So the two ones that recently got approved, obviously, that's available in the clinic, which is the Pomalyst and the carfilzomib. So I think the studies that are looking at combinations of these drugs with the other existing drugs, clearly, if they show good activity like the pomalidomide and the Velcade dexamethasone combinations, those are ready to go into larger clinical trials and hopefully would be available for, and can be used in the clinic. Among the drugs which are not been approved, the ones which are the most advanced in terms of clinical trials would be the elotuzumab, the monoclonal antibody. The results from those trials should be available, I think, the earliest. The MLN9708 or the new proteasome inhibitor, the oral proteasome inhibitor, the clinical trials are already ongoing and patients are already being accrued. So that drug, I think, again, would be closer to the clinic. Then there's the daratumumab, which again is going to go to FDA for approval in the next year or two, is very close to the clinic. Then there are a couple of drugs which are not present at ASCO, but were present at ASH. One of them is a drug called ARRY-520, and another drug called dinacyclib, both of which seems to have effect against myeloma when used alone. And I think those drugs are also going to be going in for approval evaluation in the near future.
Thank you, Dr. Kumar. I would hand it over to Gary to now begin with the panelist discussion. Gary, you're on air.
Yes. Thank you, Dr. Kumar, for a very, very well-formed discussion of that meeting. And as a matter of fact, you've touched on a few of my questions, so you got me having to think a little bit. One of the things you talked about was the minimal residual disease, and I was going to ask about that, but you pretty much answered all of it except for, is it currently being used by Mayo Clinic as a measure of the success of treatments?
Right. So we have been doing routinely on the bone marrow flow cytometry. So the answer to the initial answer to that question is yes, we do the test at this point, and so we have a sense of who is getting to a deeper responses versus who is not. However, what we really need is the data showing that if we do something different to the people who did not get that minimal residual disease negative state, it's going to change the outcome for those patients. And I think that is the key piece that we need before this becomes something that we would routinely use in the clinic.
Okay, well, thank you. You also had, and I just wanted to touch base on it as well, there's this immune therapy that they're talking about with new drugs like daratumumab and elotuzumab. But my question is, how do you see this fitting into the treatment of myeloma? Do you see a combination, and really this is my question, do you see a combination like daratumumab, Velcade, Revlimid, and Dex going to a phase 3 trial, putting that combination to use?
Right. I think you totally hit on the point here. The beauty of these monoclonal antibodies is they, especially when they are efficacious on their own, is the fact that they usually don't have side effects which are overlapping with these other types of medications like Velcade and Revlimid. So those drugs are ripe for combining with these existing combinations. So something like a Velcade, Revlimid, dexamethasone, or carfilzomib, Revlimid, dexamethasone can be combined with something like elotuzumab or daratumumab, and without significantly changing the toxicity profile, but potentially improving upon the efficacy of the combination. So that would be like the approach that was taken in lymphoma when rituximab came along, and the rituximab was added to the CHOP chemotherapy, which was the standard of care at that time. So I envisage that's the kind of approach we'll be taking with these monoclonal antibodies.
That sounds wonderful. Pat, your question?
Great. Hello, doctor. And I'm a former Mayo Clinic patient, and the questions that I'll ask tonight, I'd like a little insight into any promising Mayo Clinic projects that you and your colleagues are working on. I know Dr. Dispensieri at one point was working on a project that was doing something with a measles vaccine, and there are a couple other maybe exotic things that you don't normally hear about. Could you give us some insight, maybe a sneak peek?
Oh, absolutely. So, the focus of the, we have quite a multifaceted research program looking at the disease spectrum. So there's a lot of research going into understanding why patients develop this whole problem in the first place and why patients with monoclonal gammopathy eventually develop multiple myeloma. So that is, that kind of stems from a lot of the initial studies that Dr. Kyle had done looking at the epidemiology of this disease and, trying to define the different types or different stages of the disease. Now, in terms of actual treatment for multiple myeloma or full-blown myeloma, we are looking at a lot of new drugs, some of which you obviously have heard of. We have been deeply involved with the development of pomalidomide. We did all those initial trials, and now we are looking at the combination of pomalidomide with Velcade and dexamethasone that Dr. Lacey is heading up. I have been involved with several of the trials looking at the MLN-9708, which is the oral proteasome inhibitor. We also have the measles program is still ongoing. There are patients still being enrolled on the clinical trial looking at the measles vaccine, which has been modified. There's also a different virus that is currently going into clinical trial that is also kind of retrained or retargeted to destroy the myeloma cells. We have clinical trials that are looking at some early drugs. There's a PIMP kinase, something called a PIMP kinase inhibitor that we're doing a clinical trial with along with other centers. It's a drug that's coming from Novartis. There's also clinical trials looking at the existing drugs but trying to use it in a different context. So, for example, we have several trials that are looking at the stem cell transplant arena, trying to see if we can make the transplant procedure more efficacious and the effect more long-lasting. So we have one trial where we are combining carfilzomib with melphalan as part of the conditioning therapy prior to stem cell transplant. There's a second trial that's looking at the combination of Velcade and melphalan along with small doses of radiation for prior to transplant. The third trial looking at the carfilzomib given as consolidation treatment after transplant. Then another trial that we are hoping to open up in the near future where patients with stem cell transplant can get maintenance therapy with Revlimid along with something called a hedgehog inhibitor, which has been shown to maybe affect the myeloma stem cells. So we are hoping that may be something that could that might be promising. So a variety of different clinical trials. Then there's a whole bunch of studies looking into the genetics of this disease, especially what happens when the disease evolves in terms of the genetic makeup of the cells, what makes some of the myelomas high risk, such as the quarter of those patients with myeloma who die in the first 2 or 3 years. What is it about the disease that makes it more aggressive? So the investigators at all three sites in the Mayo Clinic, Rochester, Arizona, and Jacksonville, we work together on many of these projects.
That's a very impressive list. Thank you, Doctor.
Pat, do you have a follow-up?
No, I'm good. I've got another question, but why don't you go on to Nick, Gary?
Okay. Hey, let's see. Jack, I think it's up to you at this point. Do you have a question, Jack?
I do. Can you hear me?
Okay. Yes.
Okay. My question has to do with maintenance treatment, which has shown significant improvement in progression-free survival. But I've recently heard that there have been some overall survival benefits shown, and I'm wondering if you can provide more specific overall survival comparisons.
Sure. So, the maintenance therapy is not a new concept. It's been around for a long, long time. And it kind of arose from the point when we started doing more and more stem cell transplants. Can we kind of keep people on a small dose of something to make the responses from transplant last longer? But now that with all the new drugs that have come along, the whole concept has kind of changed in a way that we no longer talk about maintenance therapy just in the context of transplant. We are talking about it in the context of non-transplant treatments as well. So it's become a little bit of a gray zone as to what is really maintenance therapy versus just continuation of the same therapy that patients have started on for treatment of myeloma. So it boils down to one thing: how long do people need to be treated? So in the context of stem cell transplant, there were two large trials done. There was one done in the U.S., which showed that patients who got Revlimid maintenance not only had an improved time for the myeloma to come back, but they also lived longer. And then there was a French study which only showed that improvement in the progression-free survival, but has not, as of today, shown any improvement in the overall survival. Now, why are the two studies different in their results? There are some differences in the way the trials were done which could explain it. In the French trial, everybody got a couple cycles of Revlimid and dexamethasone after the stem cell transplant. So maybe that actually kind of wiped out the differences between the two arms. The patients who were enrolled in the trial in the U.S., they were all... they could have gotten any kind of therapy before the transplant, and it seemed like the people who actually got Revlimid were the ones who actually benefited more from the maintenance, suggesting that maybe the people who really benefit from this maintenance therapy post-transplant are those the ones in whom we already know the Revlimid is active. So I think there's still some question out there in terms of the overall survival benefit. And the reason why it hasn't been universally adopted by everyone is the fact that there's also concern about increased risk of second cancers when Revlimid is used as maintenance treatment. So I think we need to wait and see what the French trial results show. But meanwhile, I think what many of us are doing is to use the maintenance therapy in selected patients where the risk of myeloma coming back is fairly high, which would include patients, you know, with high-risk disease or patients in whom this transplant has not resulted in a very good partial response or better. Now, Velcade also has been used for maintenance in the post-transplant setting. There was a Dutch trial that showed that patients who got Velcade in the beginning, then got transplant, and then got Velcade again, did better in terms of their overall survival. But the difficulty there is teasing apart whether the improved overall survival was because Velcade was given in maintenance phase or whether it was given initially at the time of diagnosis of myeloma. Now, in the non-transplant setting, Dr. Palumbo has presented results from several, as well as the Spanish group has presented results from trials where they have used maintenance therapy after a defined 12 to 18 months of treatment with melphalan-containing combinations in the older patients. And they have shown that people who get the maintenance therapy clearly have an improved progression-free survival, but is still not all trials show a consistent improvement in the overall survival. So I think, you know, bottom line is do patients, if you continue to treat patients for a long time versus if you treated patients in an intermittent basis, treating each time then the myeloma starts coming up, are we fundamentally altering the natural history of the disease or are they equivalent? And I think at the end of the day, the answer is going to be that my feeling is that it's going to be true for some patients, probably the patients with high-risk myeloma where I think continued treatment for long periods of time is probably very beneficial, whereas for patients with standard-risk myeloma, we might get similar benefits by just treating them on and off until we, you know, can develop some kind of a regimen which can cure these patients, then it's a different story.
Dr. Kumar, do you have a standard length of time you're using maintenance for, or are you looking at it with respect to standard versus high-risk patients?
So what we have been doing is in patients with high-risk disease, we put all of them on maintenance therapy, and many of them actually go on Velcade maintenance therapy. And we usually give it in the high-risk patients, I tend to give it more till the myeloma comes back or unless they develop some side effects. In patients in whom they start the Revlimid maintenance, I typically give it for about 18 months to 2 years after the transplant, primarily based on the data that we have showing that most of those increased risk of cancers tend to happen from that point onwards.
Thanks very much.
Thanks, Jack. Nick, are you on?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
You bet.
Okay. Well, Dr. Kumar, very nice to meet you. And you did address a lot of the topics that, I was going to raise as well, but I've still got a couple up my sleeve here. And one of them, one's a question that I've asked before, and it's a little bit controversial, but that always makes it interesting. full disclosure, I was treated by Dr. Barlagi. So I'm a total therapy graduate, I guess you could say, although I'm still in I'm still in year four of maintenance. You'd mentioned the MRD testing, which does seem to be a popular topic, and obviously one use of it is as you described, which is to see when one might stop therapy if one feels one has reached maximum efficacy, or obviously waiting to see if there's a value in continuing to treat if it's found that there is residual cancer after other tests appear to be in remission. But the other way to look at it would be whether or not a fully clean MRD result could be indicative of something more profound than just remission. And, you know, the IMF announced it under the dramatic banner heading of Black Swan, which calls you know, the connection to the presence of patients that, though rare, might be cured. And obviously, Arkansas and some other centers using the MRD test that was developed in Salamanca think that some patients are being cured. I'd be interested to know what percent of MRD tests are completely negative, and do you think any of those patients might actually be completely rid of the disease?
So the proportion of patients who are MRD negative in the different studies depends on the test that is used. But overall, if you just take the patients who have a complete response and you do the MRD test in them, so anywhere in the 20 to 40% of the patients among the different studies may be considered to be MRD negative. Mm-hmm. And we know that these patients live definitely much longer than the patients who are MRD positive, and that's consistent across different studies. Now, the question that we really don't know is how much of, you know, all these patients from individual studies have received the same treatment. So clearly there is a component of the disease biology that allows somebody to go into a minimal residual disease negative state, which obviously plays a role. So the type of treatment is important. So some treatment may be more effective and more likely that a given person would get to MRD negative. And then there's the aspect of the disease biology that dictates whether a particular person will be able to get an MRD negative state with any treatment. And then, so those two are important determinants as to whether, you know, the MRD negativity might mean something. I guess the other part of your question was... I probably missed out on the last part of your question.
No, I think you were leading into it, which is it would be what does that something mean, and I think the only real answer is we don't know, but time will tell, right?
Right, and the question too is, you know, when you talk about cure, you know, it means different things for different people, and that is the hard thing about this disease because it, you know, it occurs in the vast majority are older patients. So if somebody is 75, has myeloma, and we give them, they need three or four treatments, and their myeloma is kept under control for 15 or 20 years, for all practical purposes, that person is cured from myeloma because, you know, he or she is going to die of something else.
Mm-hmm.
It's a totally different story for somebody who is 40, where we, you know, we are talking about controlling things for 40 to 50 years, where, you know, just controlling it may not be enough, and we want to eradicate it to the maximum extent possible. And then there's this whole biology component where, you know, we know some of these myelomas are very indolent. You give them a little of something and then it kind of becomes quiet, then stays away for 5-6 years and then comes back, you give something else. And we all have patients in the clinic who have had diagnosis 20 years ago who have seen little of treatments every now and then and have, you know, just done well and this thing kind of stays in the background. So I think the key is for the future, I think, is to understand who needs what type or what how aggressive therapy. And then it goes into kind of biologically labeling the disease into different types and saying a given patient has this type of myeloma, so we need to do this type of therapy only and does not need aggressive therapy or vice versa.
Thank you. That's a very sophisticated answer to a blunt question. I've got one other, which, and the fact that it took me a while to come up with a second question is perhaps indicative of why I'm asking it. I've been through a fair amount of high-dose chemotherapy, and I'm aware of this notion of post-chemotherapy cognitive impairment, which we happily call chemo brain. I'm wondering what, if anything, Mayo does to treat that. I gather that it's a temporary phenomenon and that it's not, you know, fully destructive on a quality of life, but I think my boss, among others, would like it if I was functioning at peak performance rather than 85%.
It's something you hear all the time, and it's not anything unique to myeloma. I think it's across all different cancers where, you know, even situations where you're not using high-dose chemotherapy, patients do complain of, you know, the difficulty in concentrating or focusing. Now, I think there's a lot of research going on in terms of trying to understand what causes this. We are not actively doing anything right now in the myeloma area at Mayo looking into this. but it is something that other investigators at Mayo, particularly in other cancer types or across different cancer types, have been looking at. There is really no good answer to why it happens or whether there's any common mechanism for different drugs. You know, obviously some drugs can cause people to be a little sleepy. That clearly impairs their ability to focus on things. Things like dexamethasone clearly can have a problem. So I think it is something that does improve over time. And clearly, as you said, you know, it is more obvious for people who are already highly functioning or involved in a lot of work compared to somebody who might not be actively working or maybe retired and may not necessarily notice that difference in the level of functioning.
Got it.
Well, thank you, Doctor, and thank you, Nick. Priya, at this point,
yep.
I think we can open it up to the listeners' questions.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you, Gary. Listeners who have questions for our panel, may please press 1 on your keypads, and we will bring you live to ask your question. Listeners who have questions for our panel, may please press 1 on your keypads, and we will bring you live to ask your question. In the meantime, we have received a lot of questions via email. Maybe we'll go over to them. Listeners can always press 1, and as soon as you press 1, we'll bring you live to ask your question.
Okay, Abdul has one, and it is, I'm a male of age 65 plus, was diagnosed with MM since 2008, and have been on Revlimid since then. Here's my question. Can Revlimid cause symptoms of angina? I have a thorough exam by a cardiologist and even did heart cath. There is some blockage in one part, but he did not recommend stent. In fact, he is one who asked me this question, that I should ask this question of an expert.
So, it's not uncommon for people to stay on Revlimid for years on the end. And the angina is not something that I have seen among the patients whom I have treated or have heard about before. So I do not think Revlimid should be contributing to the angina. The main things that we have seen with long-term Revlimid therapy is fatigue, and also some patients do complain of diarrhea or other, gastrointestinal disturbances, but clearly not angina.
Okay. Priya, anybody online yet?
No, not yet, Gary, but I can see people who, Justine has actually sent in a couple of questions. He's with us. Justine, would you like to come on air to ask your question? Justine?
Yes. Dr. Kumar, we have one from Sandra. And what about the new information on thalidomide and curcumin in one pill? Will that be approved? Have you heard of that? Of course you have.
Yeah, well, the curcumin has been, it's been studied in a lot of the laboratory studies, and there's probably something in there that clearly affects the myeloma cell. The question is whether we can get enough of it into someone to actually make a difference to the disease. So I think the answer is, I guess, let's wait for the clinical trials.
Yeah, there was a thalidomide curcumin, right? Is that putting it together in a pill? They're doing something with that?
Yeah, I don't know about the specific information about the combination, but
okay.
I know the curcumin is being studied.
Okay. We have another one from Amy, and she says, in treating relapsed multiple myeloma, is it best to revert back to the initial induction treatment if PR was achieved or begin a new combination of drugs?
If the initial treatment that was used for induction actually worked and it was stopped well before the myeloma came back, I certainly would favor trying it again.
Okay. Richard has one. He said, do you think elotuzumab is likely to be a dramatic improvement in myeloma treatment like Rituxan,
Rituxan,
was in lymphoma? When is elotuzumab likely to be approved?
Well, the results of the phase 3 trial probably will be out sometime next year. So it all depends on what we find in the clinical trial, the phase 3 trial. If it shows significant improvement, then I assume that we will have that. That will be approved, and best guess is probably, you know, in another year and a half, 2 years.
Do you see it as a game changer? I guess that was the other question.
Well, I guess it all depends on what the clinical trial results show. You know, the phase 2 trial results, if the same responses we saw in the phase 2 trial results holds up in the phase 3, then I think it's definitely going to be a dramatic improvement.
Great. Joshua asks, what are the possible advantages or disadvantages of having multiple stem cell transplants over time? Do the transplants become less effective for the patient after each one?
Right. So increasingly we are doing the second and third transplants, you know, as people are living longer and longer and people are on these new treatments. One of the things that happens is after a while, their bone marrow reserve goes down, and it becomes difficult to tolerate the medications. So in those settings, you know, if you have stem cells already collected, it's a good time to do another transplant because it kind of resets your bone marrow, and they can actually get treatments which they couldn't have been or would not have been able to before. The second thing is in patients in whom the first transplant kept the myeloma away for 2 years or more, it's certainly reasonable to consider doing another transplant. And typically what we have seen is each subsequent transplant is probably going to last less than what the initial transplant did. So while there is, you know, cumulative information would suggest that a second transplant is a very reasonable option in somebody where the first transplant gave a reasonable duration of myeloma staying away, I think the information on, you know, yet another transplant, I think, is probably still minimal.
Okay. Priya, anybody online?
Not yet, but Justina sent us his question via email. Dr. Justine wants to know, is a monthly blood work the best way to keep track of a complete remission?
Yeah, I think, you know, at this point, the way we define complete response, blood test is the way to continue to monitor that. It doesn't necessarily have to be you know, on a monthly basis. It can be less often, every 2 to 3 months. That's fine as well. Once the myeloma is coming back, we will start seeing those protein come up in the blood or the urine, depending upon, you know, where it was, what type of protein was found initially.
We have Barbara asking, I'm having significant bone pain in my back, spine area, and in my pelvic area. I had an MRI a week ago. My doctor said I have a herniated disc in the area. I'm concerned. Could I now be experiencing possible bone fractures as well as potential collapse of my spine?
Well, if the MRI did not show anything else other than just the bulging disc, then I wouldn't be worried about it. So it's fairly sensitive test to pick up if anything's happening there.
Okay. Yes, Irma, she wants to know, when will there be an accepted standard for MRD negative in myeloma? What is Mayo's definition?
What do you call MRD negativity? So if you, the way we have been doing that is, again, flow cytometry based, and if you find, you know, less than 20 cells or 20 myeloma cells, I mean, I would say less than 1 in 10,000 myeloma cells would be considered an MRD negative.
She goes on to ask, is it helpful to monitor markers of bone turnover, such as N-urinary telopeptide, in patients who are in remission?
No, there is no proven role for monitoring the N-telopeptide as a marker for myeloma being active or not at this time.
Yes, we have a question from Abdul, who's a myeloma patient. He says, my ENT doctor indicated that the platinum kind of element in chemotherapy usually affects the nerves of the hearing system in a destructive way. Is this really so? If the answer is yes, are there any remedies to counter this side effect?
So the platinum type of drugs can cause damage to the hearing by affecting the nerves. But we don't use platinum type of drugs much in multiple myeloma, except in the in a particular regimen called the VDT PACE or VRD PACE, which is used mostly in Arkansas, but also sometimes we use it in patients with relapsed disease too.
We have a caller online who wants to ask a question. The person calling in from 718983, please ask your question.
Yes, good evening, Dr. Kimura. I have a question concerning someone with smoldering multiple myeloma.
Yes.
What degree of bone involvement is required to recommend IV bisphosphonate therapy only? Osteopenia, overt osteoporosis, and/or fractures related to either? And then second part of that question, could IV Zometa or another IV bisphosphonate be used to prevent or slow down progression to active disease?
Right. So I think if anybody who has osteopenia that is above what is suspected for their age, I think they certainly would benefit from getting bisphosphonate therapy. Either of them can be used. Again, it all depends. In the context of smoldering multiple myeloma, if somebody has significant osteopenia or osteoporosis, I would definitely put them on IV bisphosphonates. It could be either IV Zometa or IV Eridia. The treatment in terms of the bisphosphonates preventing the risk of progression to myeloma, the clinical trials that were done has not shown any effect on the risk of progression.
Thank you, doctor. Appreciate that very much.
Dr. Kumar, we have a question from Richard who asks, multiple myeloma attacks the immune system. Why are we not testing natural as well as pharmaceutical products that build the immune system? And why study iron? Its side effects are more hurtful than beneficial.
So what is the last thing? Study what?
Iron.
Okay. No, I think the immune system is definitely affected in multiple myeloma. And, you know, there are studies ongoing trying to see if we can somehow redirect the body's immune system to try and attack the myeloma cells. There are no clinical trials looking at non-specific ways of kind of boosting the immune system because, you know, it's hard to prove that, you know, these kind of natural products really does what it's supposed to do in terms of, you know, boosting the immune system. But I think approaches to specifically kind of harness the ability of the immune system to attack the myeloma cells would have some role to play in the future once we figure out how to do it. And with respect to the iron therapy, you know, there is no clear, you know, direct relationship with any kind of immune effects of that. And you use iron therapy, obviously, in patients who would have iron deficiency.
Thank you, doctor. We have Patricia writing, asking that she's been off chemo since June 2012, and she did a clinical trial which was unsuccessful in August to November 2012 at Johns Hopkins, and then she began the trial with kappa free light number at 188, ending with 583, which was an 83-point decrease from the previous month. In the following month, the number jumped to 756. She says, I think this is an error. I'm feeling new strength every day and can do more tasks than ever. I'm happy with my quality of life and don't want to resume chemo based on what I think is an error. How do I approach this with my hematologist? I still get Zometa once a month for bone strength. It's such a low kappa free light number initially and prior to the trial. Was a clinical trial or stem cell transplant recommendation necessary?
Well, I think the
quite
easy thing would be
yeah.
to recheck it and make sure that is really an error or not. And if it's an error, I think the person can be reassured and then continue to watch. But if on the other hand, if it's starting to go up, you know, it needs to be closely watched. We don't have to start treatment on everyone just based on the numbers going up. We can also carefully observe them to see if it's starting to have any bad effects and then decide on therapy. But if the number is going up fairly rapidly, I think it would be wise to get started on treatment.
We still have time. Gary, would you like to go for another round of questions with the panelists?
Yes, I would. I have a question, Doctor, and I happen to know of a patient, name unknown, who has gone through years of chemotherapy, like five or six, has done the VDT PACE and a couple stem cell transplants, and is off of maintenance, which was a VTD, and has been off for about a year and a half. And all his blood work seems to be fine, except for his IgG just continues to kind of lope along at about 399, and every once in a while he needs when he gets down there he's like a quart low, so they give him a IVIG.
Mm-hmm.
It just happens to be me, but what? Is there anything that can be, will it improve over time? Am I destined to have to go in and get every 2 or 3 months a transfusion of the IVIG, or what has been your experience? Is that typical or untypical? Have I worn out my bone marrow or what?
Yeah. Well, what happens is in patients with myeloma, it's very common to have the low immunoglobulins, especially when you have, in myeloma protein that is not the IgG type, it's more likely, it'll be more obvious because the myeloma cells probably kind of decrease the ability of the normal plasma cells to actually make any immunoglobulins. So that's the reason why the IgG tends to go down in myeloma where the myeloma protein is non-IgG. In myeloma where it is IgG is the type of myeloma protein, it's hard to differentiate between what is the normal immunoglobulin and what is the abnormal immunoglobulin coming from the myeloma. Now, routinely, we do not give patients with low immunoglobulin levels IVIG all the time. We use it selectively in patients who get frequent infections. And in those patients, at least, large studies have been undertaken, but the feeling is that maybe those patients can benefit from getting the IVIG infusions once in a while. Now, once the myeloma is under good control, in a good proportion of patients, the IG levels, immunoglobulin levels, will come up with treatment, and the person might need less and less of the IVIG.
Okay, well, thank you. Pat? Jack, Nick?
I have another question if we have time. Priya, do we have time?
Yes, Pat, we have time. Please go ahead.
Okay, doctor. When I was initially diagnosed and was at Mayo Clinic back in the spring of 2007, I was told that the median life expectancy was 43 months, and I planned accordingly. And now I just read and actually wrote about this retrospective study that some of your colleagues did. I don't know if you were on the team or not, that went back and looked at the patient's overall survival between 2002 and 2006. You're familiar with that, correct?
Yep. I was the one doing it. Okay.
Sure. So when a patient, is able to achieve CR and he's low risk, he or she is low risk, the overall survival median survival exceeded 10 years. And,
yes.
I'm not upset I've lived this long. It's been 6 years, and I hope to get six more or more, but it would have helped me to plan had I had the correct information. So my question is, what are you telling? So if I'm a newly diagnosed patient and I come to see you tomorrow, what are you telling him or her?
Right. So in 2007, there's no way we would have known that it would have been 10 years, that you'd have been predicting the future.
Of course.
And today, I think what we tell most patients is the median, if you take all comers, the median survival is 7 to 8 years. And if you have standard risk multiple myeloma and if you get a complete response, I think, we are talking about well over 10 years in terms of overall survival.
Well, that's great news. Thank you, Doctor.
Yeah.
That is wonderful.
Gary, I think we are almost up with our 60 minutes. That was a wonderful discussion, Dr. Kumar. Thank you very much for being with
thank
us
you.
Once again. I thank the panel, Pat, Nick, Jack, and Gary for being with us and making this such an active discussion. CureTalk thanks all its listeners and participants for your support. We look forward to having all of you join us for the next Cure Panel Talk Show on Myeloma on August 21st. Mark your calendars, our next live on-air Myeloma Support Group meet on July 31st at 6 p.m. ET. We are having a guest for the meeting this time. Attorney Anya Prince will be participating to answer all your legal queries, along with support group leaders Pat Killingsworth and Cynthia Schmilwitzki. Please register for the same and send us your questions to priya@trialix.com. For more details of our upcoming shows, please visit trialix.com/curetalk. The link for today's show will be sent via email to all participants. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Bye.